Now that Kurt Vonnegut is actually here with us at the microphone, I admit that his presence puts me in a bit of a quandary. On the one hand, Kurt Vonnegut is one of two very cogent artists, Hermann Hesse being the other, who have indeed convinced us that explanation blights. On the other hand, like every veteran reader of Vonnegut, I can hardly conceal my impatience for at least a discussion, if not an explanation, of certain pet questions. For example, I personally would love to discuss with Kurt Vonnegut what I consider to be one of the most ingenious and artistically perfect parallels in modern literature. I mean the parallel between the fate of Roland Weary in Slaughterhouse-Five and the fate of the hero Roland in the medieval Song of Roland. Even more important to most of our audience, I'm sure, is the direction in which Kurt Vonnegut's work is moving. Has he truly abandoned his right-handedness, which produced several major novels of our time? Has he truly rediscovered his innate left-handedness, which he felt would lead him into a creative period of drama? What has come of his interest in the old Italian Commedia dell'arte? And does Vonnegut want to talk about Sourdough Limited? Well, that's the only unselfish way out of the quandary, of course, to talk about what's most interesting to Kurt Vonnegut at this moment. Kurt Vonnegut, welcome to Reader's Almanac.
Well, thank you very much. Should I start answering?
Take it where you will.
Yeah. Well, I'm 50 years old, which has an awful lot to do with any crisis I've gone through. I think it's the basic crisis. It's a biological crisis. I would have gone through it if I were a Pontiac dealer. I had a large family. The children all grew up. They're all in their 20s now. And I had the role of father, and that's over. Essentially, I was fired from a job I'd had for 25 years. It was like being fired from Life magazine. It's whatever those people are feeling. These people, when they reach 50, feel anyway when their children leave. And so I thrashed around, as American writers often do, trying to build a new family by getting into theater of one sort or another, because you do get a family, a new family that way, and you do become head of a household for a while again. I tried this, putting together a play, Happy Birthday, Wanda June, and it turned out that this was an intelligent way to get a new family, as it was gratifying, and it was a sensible thing to do socially, not artistically, probably.
Well, now, you yourself pointed out that the idea for Happy Birthday, Wanda June occurred to you when you reread Homer. You decided to put Odysseus into a modern setting and to show how cruel and absurd that concept of manhood is. Would you like yourself to tell us about the origin of the character of Roland Weary?
No, well, yes, I will tell you. I had lucked out, as I've never thought of the parallel between Roland Weary and the Song of Roland, except that Roland was a name from chivalry. On the details of the Song of Roland, I surely knew them at one time, probably in high school. I don't now, and I'm enchanted that I have paralleled.
This is fantastic, then, because for all that time it was in your unconscious.
Yes, I think it really was in my unconscious.
I have a book coming out in which I trace six parallels between the Song of Roland and the life of Roland Weary in Slaughterhouse-Five. And it's really this is a perfect example of how the artist takes things in and then percolates them and works on them.
Well, when things are going well, when the writing is going well, and I know that I am a professional and in the right profession, I'm not thinking at all. It's like skiing. Great. It's where there isn't time to think. And, my mind is very good this way, is bringing things out of an essentially barbarous education in Indianapolis, that the Song of Roland was in there, and Ode to a Grecian Urn, and a few other things, and they've come to my fingertips when I've needed them.
Well, then let this be recorded as a perfect example of the artistic method. Look at all of the ways in which the last days of Roland Weary parallel days of the great heroic Roland. He has that whistle which he will not blow until he's made corporal, which is just like the horn that Roland won't blow until he's either victorious or martyred, you know? And his tracks his tracks were made for him in the snow, just the way Roland, in the song of Roland, well, his enemy knew his tracks too. And ever since that anti-tank gun of his gave the Germans the complete clue to where he was, Roland Weary's Minet.
Oh, that's beautiful. I just feel so lucky. Joseph Heller, you know, embedded all sorts of things purposely in Catch-22.
Mm-hmm.
I was dying for critics to discover them. And critics like the book so much, it's the last thing they're looking for is parallels. It's the
yeah.
book has so much figure. And so this is one of the disappointments of Heller's life, that he purposely hid things in there, and nobody dug them out. And I'm charmed that you would dig this out. My mind does this to such an extent that I really don't feel it's my mind. At 50 years old, I now feel that artists are specialized cells in a huge organism, and they are mankind attempting to become something else.
Look how beautiful your mind worked there then, because, you know, in the song of Roland, just before he expires, he looks up and sees the angels coming down to get him. And in Slaughterhouse-Five, it's Billy Pilgrim who looks up. Billy Pilgrim, the pacifist, not Roland Weary, the militarist.
Yeah.
It's Billy Pilgrim, the pacifist, who looks up and sees an angelic face in the 15, 16-year-old German boy. And there are six or seven parallels in there that just perfectly illustrate the way the artistic
you
mind works.
You make me feel very proud and educated.
I think that's what an artist has to overcome is his education. When you took that great books course up on the Cape that year, it must have hurt to see how education stifles literature and stifles literary... I suppose that one of the great things going on in education right now is that we do teach Vonnegut and Heller in the classroom instead of murdering Shakespeare and Milton, you know, whom they're not going to understand. We start from the present, and the students love it.
Yeah, it's pandering to the students. I have a large academic reputation now, and one reason is that teaching my books is a way to please students. I've taught enough to know... who the most popular author is, and you know, by forcing students to read this and then that and then that and then that and report on this author and that author, carried the secret for a long time, as they adore Joseph Conrad
mm-hmm.
and don't even notice how much they like him.
Yeah,
I myself do.
There's nothing wrong with pandering to students, though.
No, I you know, no, I don't.
I don't like the word, because one of you, somebody said that about Happy Birthday, Wanda June. One of the negative criticisms was that this was pandering to youth. There I slipped and said pondering to youth.
Yeah. well, no, that accusation has been made. Is that there's envy of me, and it's proper there should be. I myself am an envious person, but there's envy of me. And the rapport I seem to have with youth, except it's purely accidental. I mean, certainly we did not go after the youth market. And sometimes I feel like Dr. Seuss, as I'm told by some adult that the 12-year-old kid is reading me and loving me, and that's all right.
Well, have you noticed that space exploration is catching up with your early science fiction? Sirens of Titan was published in 59, and now in 1973, space scientists announced that Titan is indeed capable of bearing life?
Yeah, but this isn't a remarkable lucking out. Swift, I think, described the moons of Mars when no one could possibly see them. And I knew about Titan from the Child's First Book of Stars or something like that. It's one of these great big children's books with nice drawings of the solar system and the description of the planets one by one. And I read about the moons of Saturn, and one of these was about the size, a little smaller than Mars, I guess, and there was a possibility. The Child's First Book of the Universe said there was a possibility that there was life there, so this was not Now that we're talking about exploring Titans, does not prove that I had magical powers that guessed this place was inhabitable. People have known that for a long time.
Well, science fiction is so damn logical that, you know, this is... You start there. You start with the logical. After that, I guess the imagination takes over, but...
Well, what bothered me about another thing I learned from the Child's First Book of the Stars was that the distances were so enormous, we could never go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I would wonder why Arthur Clarke and Robert Heinlein and those people would honestly think we could travel distances of that sort. As far as I'm concerned, this is the only planet we have, and it's the only one we'll ever have. And this... I was in on the first moonshot when they set foot on the moon. At CBS assembled a very unlikely group of people in one room, and they would form round tables of us and when nothing else was going on. And at one point there, after the man had set foot on the moon, Heinlein and Arthur Clarke talked on the telephone, and Clarke was yelling at him, "It begins, it begins, it begins." And Jerome Beatty, who is an intelligent man, he used to work for the Saturday Review, was there with me. And Beatty was saying, "It ends, it ends, it ends." And what Beatty meant was there was nothing on the moon. And there isn't going to be much on anything else either.
Yeah. Well, this brings us to Between Time and Timbuktu. Would you care to talk about the book version of that?
Well, this was a mistake. We gave permission to NET to take a bunch of my stories and put them together into a one-hour show. And then we thought we would make a book so that NET could make some money off of it. And... It turned out to be sort of a lousy book, and it turned out to be a not completely satisfactory television show either. It was satisfactory enough. It's an enormously expensive thing to do, which is one reason I dislike film, is that cost $100,000 of public money, of Rockefeller money, of BBC money. And when something did not work, we needed another $3,000 to fix it. It costs that much to patch a piece of film. And so the thing was an approximation. It finally was sort of like this spring pageant at Putney or something like that. It was close enough, you know, and a bunch of nice kids had been involved in it.
Well, you must have worked on the script a long time because the book was announced for October originally.
Well, what slowed the book down was simply the artwork. It's an extraordinary job of book designing.
I see.
And I'm sorry that the name of the designer isn't on the tip of my tongue, because it's essentially his masterpiece to make a book out of a television show. It's a stunning book visually, I think.
Well, when the book comes out, we'll talk about that. Yeah. We do on this show. We like to look at a book completely. Well, in writing Slaughterhouse-Five, you... finally took the position that under certain circumstances we simply must view a work of art with the author in mind. At least in Slaughterhouse-Five you make it clear that the author's troubles in facing the story are an important part of the story. And your introduction to the book version of Happy Birthday also seemed to say that at the moment you wanted us to see creation and creator together. Do you still feel that way about your current work?
Yes, and this is a privilege it comes with at the end or at the middle of a long career. I've been writing since 1950, essentially. I've been a freelancer since 1950, and I began as a stranger, and I had to write as a stranger, as nobody had read me. But now people know who I am, and people came to know who F. Scott Fitzgerald was, and it helped the reader. I gave Fitzgerald an extra character in Gatsby, for instance. As Fitzgerald was well enough known that he could be a character in Gatsby, and a useful one, because he had a public image, and I have a public image now. And one reason why novels often cannot be translated to the screen is that they wind up on the screen one character short. The reason there has never been a good movie based on a Hemingway story is that no movie makers found a way of putting Hemingway up on the screen along with the story. I would think, I mean, I propose this halfway seriously, is if in one corner, if you were making a Hemingway movie, if you would have a small circular inset up in one corner of the screen with a picture of this big bearded man. It was just always up there, just a still picture to remind you that this had been written by this man. It would give it an extremely interesting and desirable dimension.
Well, I've taken the position in talking about this that you were moving toward that long before Slaughterhouse-Five. In other words, long before anybody knew you except the underground.
Mm-hmm.
Because during the 60s, in your public appearances with students, it just seemed that you were meeting their demand that the creator and the creation be the same. Wasn't that helping you, your contact with students during the 60s?
Yeah, I found that they insisted I be certain things and that I was valuable to them as a personality. This is disturbing in a way. One reason I've stopped making public appearances is that I disappoint so many people, because I'm not what they think I am. As this happened at West Point, I was at West Point last year, and after my lecture, a guy came forward, a cadet, and he had been looking forward to meeting me. And he said, "I don't think you, I can't imagine you wrote those books." And I had, I swear to God I had, but I was not the man he thought should have written those books. I run into enough anger in audiences that I decided that public appearances aren't worth it. I mean, that's very squeamish. I mean, it's leading a very soft life is not to expose myself to any sort of aggravation. But there is disappointment in what I actually am, what I look like, how I talk.
But anybody who's read your works knows that the themes of your works already include that, you know. That I remember one Bostonian wrote a long article for the Times on the masks of Kurt Vonnegut, and
mm-hmm.
The funny thing that he left out throughout is, of course, that Vonnegut himself knows about masks and how we all have so many of them and we can't ever decide on the right one, and everybody else has masks that he wants us to wear and so on.
You know, one thing is that when I am writing, and I'm sure when you're writing too, you're wearing a mask, as I've just finished a book,
mm-hmm.
and so I've thrown aside a mask, as I feel unemployed and depersonalized right now. I mean, just sort of at liberty, really, like a vaudevillian.
Yeah, if I don't hurry up and finish something that I'm writing, I'll never finish it, because I'm not going to be able to get that set of my features again.
Yeah.
It's an awful thing, but it keeps us terribly reminded of what reality is all about, I guess. In your first chapter of Slaughterhouse-Five, you mentioned your teaching at Iowa, and then you made a cryptic reference to you having gotten into trouble and then out of it again, and after the book was published, you taught once again, this time at Harvard. What are your views now about the value of writers' conferences and courses in creative writing? They still go on, you know.
Yeah, well, they are worth doing on a social level. There's a lot of people who come to those conferences are lonesome people looking for something new to do, people who have disagreeable jobs, whose marriages are broken up, who are at loose ends. And it's a nice halfway house, a writing conference is. The person is allowed to finger paint and to be an irresponsible, playful creator. And it's comforting to those people. There is a social function to writers' conferences. They're entertaining. They don't last very long. The really good one, I think, as far as summer programs goes, the really good program is at Indiana University, where they encourage you to come back year after year after year. But teaching at Harvard, for instance, I would require students to write something in one semester, but at the same time knowing that a real writer in the same period of time might not be able to write anything, or nothing any good. The semester isn't a very long time. But the Indiana University scheme of keeping track of a student over a period of 10, 20 years, maybe, is realistic and respectable.
Yeah. Well, I find at writers' conferences, though, that our terrible loneliness figures here. You know, even in New York, you can't find enough writers to make a community. You understand why in ancient Athens and in Shakespeare's London and so on, there were always places where writers congregated.
Yeah.
We're terribly paranoid people, in a certain sense, because we're always taking a risk, and we're never sure, and we're the ones who are going to take the full responsibility for the risk. And getting together and commiserating with each other is a great thing.
What, do you do much of it?
At writers' conferences? Oh, at least 2 weeks a year.
Yeah. No, it is nice. It is nice to meet writers. It's very good for the teachers, because American writers ordinarily do not see much of other American writers. And at the University of Iowa, I was forced to know Nelson Algren very well, which would have been a hard thing to do in real life, and Vance Bourgeli, who is perhaps my closest friend. I don't know, but I wouldn't have had him for a friend if I hadn't been forced to teach with him, to be in harness with him there. One thing that disturbs writers is that each writer, in order to keep going, is not as respectful of other writers as he should be. As I know that I, in a way, pity other writers for being whoever they are, and that's part of my stock in trade. And I'm sure other writers feel the same way. John Updike and I are good friends and eat together and all that, but I have misgivings about his work because I have to.
Yeah.
And he certainly has misgivings about mine.
That ego is the essence of the creative spirit, I think. Well, thank you, Kurt Vonnegut, for this delightful half hour on the question of what's new in the world of Kurt Vonnegut. I'd like to remind our audience that we've been talking with the author of Slaughterhouse-Five about his current literary views and problems. The works of Kurt Vonnegut are now available in uniform hardcover editions published by Delacorte, and in most cases there are two paperback editions, most of them in either Dell or Delta or both. All of Vonnegut's major works are now in print, all the way from Play a Piano down to Happy Birthday, Wanda June, with a new volume, Between Time and Timbuktu, expected any month now. May I add that Simon & Schuster will soon be publishing the first of two of my own critical studies on Kurt Vonnegut. Next week, we'll be talking with Ted Solitaroff about American Review No. 16. This is Walter James Miller, editor of Reader's Almanac.